also don't care about feminism. Your favorite show is Entourage.
To be honest, when I found out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I lost interest anyway.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Maximum Film. It's episode 336, and you know what? You can teach an old dog new tricks. It's your boy, Ify Whitey Way, and in the booth with me are my friends. So let me introduce you to them. First up, we have an esteemed critic, an esteemed friend, and you know what? Knows how to bake a thing or two. Alonzo Duralde, what's good?
Well, I'll tell you, Ify, my what's good is probably everybody's what's good, but I always get to go first, so ha-ha. I am, of course, speaking of the Tracy Chapman-Luke Combs duet at the Grammys this weekend. I'll tell you, I don't know where country music would be without black queer people, frankly, because I think between Lil Nas X and Tracy Chapman, we've really, you know, injected a lot into that genre. But yeah, so, you know, obviously, Tracy Chapman's Fast Car dates back to my own college days. I'm that old. I've always loved that song. I've always found that song really powerful. Love the cover. But seeing the two of them together perform that song with such just like emotional rawness, and just seeing the adoration that Luke Combs clearly has for Tracy Chapman, it was just like a beautiful moment, a great musical moment, but also like the change we wish to see in America moment. You know, like, let's have this huge country star and this queer black woman on stage, like having a love fest and bringing America together to remark upon how great this duet is. So yeah, that's my what's good.
Ooh, that's a solid what's good. And I agree. Yeah, it was truly a moment. And now it's the whole discourse is about, you know, being into multiple genres because of the era of VH1 and MTV. That is the current Twitter discourse right now. You know, speaking of worlds colliding, like, how can a West Coast Compton boy be in love with a Minnesota girl? it's none other than super festival programmer, producer Drea Clark. What is good?
So I had a different what's good, but now I'm going to piggyback on this. One, you guys know I love to show off just how on the pulse I am. So when I tell you that I found out that there was a new version of Fast Car, it was at the Grammys this year. I did not know. I was like, oh my God, Tracy Chapman, I love her so much. Oh, I love this song. Who's that young man? What's going on here? Who's, what? Is he, does she know him? Is that her son? What's happening? So that's, again, just the absolute, just cultural astuteness of one Andrea Diane Clark. Can't be stopped. But it did lead me, what I did see of it, I loved watching it. She has this beautiful smile. Honestly, I don't imagine watching Tracy Chapman and not being in love with her. But as a skincare person, I was like, okay, I get it. I understand the phrase black don't crack, but are you kidding me? She looks good. I was like, oh, I want to know everything she puts on her face. And then I rewatched her playing that song, like looking like a little tiny infant baby on stage at Wembley in front of like 60,000 people. And like, that's what sort of launched her initially. But so my what's good is, other than the slow realization that I really never know what's going on with music, is what this all led me to. Please go Google Tracy Chapman singing Stand By Me, one of the final Letterman performances.
Oh, wow.
I can't tell. It's my favorite song in the whole world now. And it was not. I am familiar with that tune. I do understand that is a cover. But yeah, that's going to be my inadvertently unplanned related to Alonzo, Tracy Chapman singing Stand By Me.
Nice.
Also, you guys, apparently there's a new version of Fast Car. Go check it out.
I mean, it was like when I found out that Woman's Work was a Kate Bush song.
Oh,
not a Maxwell.
No. Oh, yep, my soul.
Not a Maxwell. Yeah, yeah. You just know that's how some people feel about you right now, Dre.
Oh, no. But they think it the other way, right? Both versions of this story make me old. Yeah. Like, there's no winning for me.
Oh, man.
Lean in.
Look, we're all about our amazing, illustrious guest on this pod. So, you know, we have an amazing, illustrious guest on this pod. You probably saw it because it's mentioned in the title. But, you know, just in case you just jump in blind, now you know. It is chief critic for Vanity Fair, where he reviews film, theater, and TV. It is Richard Lawson. What's good?
Yay, Richard Lawson.
Hello. What's good right now, I know that I'm here to talk about movies, but I have to say we are living in a peak era of competition reality TV between The Traitors airing in the UK and the US version, and also the return of, I think, the best of them all, Australian Survivor. I don't know if any of you guys are Survivor fans, but
yeah,
the seasons
I've heard,
the seasons are longer, the episodes are longer. It airs like 4 times a week. You have to have some kind of nefarious techniques to find the episodes if you live in the US, but it's already off to a great start.
How do we get you into the challenge, Richard?
Oh, yeah. See, I was going to bring up the challenge as well. Yeah,
I am a long, long time challenge watcher to the extent that my partner once got me a cameo for my birthday from someone from the challenge.
Say who we got here.
It was
Johnny Bananas?
Or...
He doesn't have that kind of money.
He doesn't have CT cameo money.
We don't have CT money in this house, sadly. But no, it was Nicole from Staten Island. She was kind of a later addition.
Oh my gosh, I'm sorry, the firefighter?
Yes,
yeah, she was still actively
fighting.
She turned
like two women onto their sexuality. Lauren?
Yeah.
I'm in.
So she called with her unique accent and wished me happy birthday, and it was a thrill of a lifetime.
Okay, I'm loving
you
all
guys,
of this.
You guys thought you were going to out-media Richard Lawson.
I'm a little amused here.
I can't believe we're sitting here. Laurel's coming. I mean, I'm still in love with Laurel, and she's here, and I got to do. These goyles are going to kill me. These Laurel's here, and I'm in an elimination. Laurel is so hot and can definitely get it. You know, we have a joint hall pass, me and M, and we're gonna definitely like you from across the bar, Laurel. Any bar that we're at, I'm ready. But you know, I don't know how deep you're in the current season, but I was riding for Kylan, and a lot of people don't like Kylan. I like, but now it's Nerisse, baby. Ooh, I doubted you at first, but now you coming in strong, and that is the challenge talk for today's episode. But now we're going for some good stuff.
Iffy, what's good?
Yeah. What's good with me?
I was going to say, it's got to be more than just Laurel.
What's good with me? I just got back from St. Louis with my buddy Garrick doing a weekend out there. It was super fun, but I definitely want to shout out a Nigerian restaurant in St. Louis called Levels Nigerian Cuisine, which was great, which also had me do the thing I always do when I have pepe soup, which is forgetting that it is extremely peppery and spicy. So, you know, with a soup you sip and you definitely feel like that Idris Elba meme of him on the hot ones coughing, because it just hits the back of your throat and it's like getting punched in the back of the throat. But yeah, that's good with me. Just Nigerian food with friends in a different city. I didn't get any toasted ravis this time, which I'm sad about. I'm not sad about skipping emos. If you're from St. Louis and you think it's good, you're wrong. Just gonna let you know right there, you're
shots
wrong.
Fired.
Yeah, no, it is the lukewarmest take. It is a city that has been going through a bout of what is it called when you're held captive and then you start to love your captive.
Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah, that's if you think emos is good, it's Stockholm syndrome. It's not good. Don't tell me that I ordered it wrong. No variation of toppings will make Provel cheese not super salty and overpower the rest of the pizza. Now we're talking about overpowering. Let's talk about overpowering some scenes, because we're messing around with Maestro today, the Bradley Cooper vehicle. Then we'll have a movie quiz about movie composers, but not the kind of movie composers you're thinking of. But first, it's time for ITIDIC, our movie news segment, where we break down the acronym ITIDIC, which stands for Is This Important? Do I Care? By going through the week's movie news and answering that very question. Drea, why don't you kick this off?
All right. Newly Oscar-nominated actor America Ferrera is taking a turn in the director's chair. She'll make her directorial debut with an adaptation of a novel by Erica Sanchez called I Am Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter. This film was originally announced a few years ago, is back in the news now that it's moved from development at Netflix to Orion Pictures. Is this important? Do you care?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we're always talking about the dearth of women and people of color, let alone both, in the director's chair. Eva Longoria made her feature debut last year with Flamin' Hot. So obviously, if there's now a pipeline for Latina actresses to, you know, make that jump behind the camera, then, you know, let's have more of it. Sure.
And similar to Ava, well, A, that the script shares a screenwriter, Linda Yvette Chavez, but with Flamin' Hot, but also they both started by directing their own TV shows. I know America had several credits on
Superstore.
Almost said Superbad. Superstore. Superstore, yeah. Totally different. And Gentified?
Hentified.
Yeah.
Hentified. I was Hentified. Making the face, and I was staring at Alonzo through the Zoom. You can't tell where I was looking. I was like, who's going to give me a bigger look for how I misspoke about that? But yeah, I'm excited for this. I think that she makes interesting choices in the project she takes. She's done a few indies that I really dig, and I'm very glad that she got on to support them on lower budget levels. And yes, this is certainly an area where it's fun to see someone branching out, digging in their heels as a director, and obviously leaning into something that is very personal to them, the background of it, of this story, and that it's not just a generic, oh, I want to get into directing. Mayhaps there's a white couple I can have fall in love. So
here's a Transformer.
I'd watch her Bumblebee.
Oh, well, no.
Don't let me hold you back, America.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, as much as this feels like a setup for a dirty joke, it isn't. I'm a big fan of pipelines, especially when it gets marginalized voices to, you know, in the forefront and having like a system in place to kind of share those stories. I think we've talked about it many, many times on this pod before, but I think in general, we know that people are hungry for stories told by diverse voices. So let's get a system that the WB can't try and rip apart like they have.
I was gonna ask Richard if he was gonna, you know, check this one out, but he probably already has, even though it hasn't been made yet.
Yeah, they screen everything for me before they actually film the movies, which is really helpful for my job.
Man, you get all the perks.
I just love when someone capitalizes on a moment of success in an interesting way. Like, she had a great 2023, America Ferrera, obviously, and you know, in maybe even 5 years ago, it would have been, you know, I'm going to be in a Marvel movie or whatever. But this is actually like an interesting use of that sudden power to get something interesting made.
And I think Coleman Domingo's done the same thing. Like, he's what's the film? He just signed on to direct something.
Oh, I didn't hear about this.
He had it ready to go. I'm looking it up, but by the way, he was cast as in the Michael Jackson biopic as Joe Jackson, but he's also directing something and I can't find it because every single article that's coming up is about how he and his husband met on a Craigslist misconnections. Sorry.
That's hilarious because the first thing I remember seeing Coleman Domingo do was on the Big Gay Sketch Show, and he would do Maya Angelou reads the Craigslist gay misconnections ads.
No.
Yes. It was brilliantly
inspired
funny.
By real life. Who knew?
Yes.
He's got a bunch of projects coming up, too. And yeah, I'm all for capitalizing.
Nice.
Oh, well, you know, speaking of capitalizing, Universal Studios Florida reveals more plans for Epic Universe theme park. Just when you thought Orlando was all full up on theme parks, Universal Studios announced an entire new mega park that is calling Epic Universe. Some details of Epic Universe have now been revealed. We now know that portals at the park will lead to four different lands of amusement: Super Nintendo World, the Ministry of Magic, which looks like a 1920s era of the Wizarding World, and the Isle of Berk from the How to Train Your Dragon movies, and Dark Universe Reborn, which spotlights Universal horror characters. The reason I yelled Reborn is because they tried to do a Dark Universe Marvel-esque thing that fumbled because the Mummy remake didn't do that well. The park is set to open in 2025. Is this important? Do you care?
I had a joke all ready to go about the Dark Universe, but of course now you can't even do that because they're ahead of you. And they're like, no, we're really doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, this Wizarding World, I'm doing my best to not put another dime in that woman's pocket, but it sounds to me like they're basing it on that last batch of movies Fantastic that no one likes. Beasts. Thank you. Yes, that one. So it's like, oh yeah, great. We people lined up not to go to that movie, and now you're going to make a theme park out of it. Great.
I'm torn on these because I'm someone with zero interest in going to them myself, because I do not enjoy other people, and I don't have children to bring and deal with other people for. But I do think I remember going as a kid. And I think there is an imagination unlocking that can come with being in a place like that. Like, it seems sort of fantastical and fun. And I do like the themes of this. And also, there are a lot of artists that work on these in really cool ways. My friend Aaron, who's a VFX person, worked for years on, like, the background of these. And so I do like unlocking some sort of different form of artistry and technology to bring these all together. Do I want to be, I think we've said before, like, I would befriend old Tommy Cruise for a day for him to buy out the park. And then I get my own little golf cart, go bit to bit. And then I'm also not paying old JoJo any money myself either. So yeah, that would be a win-win for me.
I mean, I'm not anti theme park. I think it's cool when there's like fun new innovations and, you know, using the new technology and all that kind of stuff. But it's weirdly enough, this is making me have more respect for Walt Disney, because he at least built a theme park around these sort of conceptual ideas about like the frontier and Tomorrowland, as opposed to like this franchise and that franchise and, you know, this t-shirt that we want to sell you. Like, these are also branded and marketed as concepts. And I mean, apart from the Dark Universe, I'm not even sure how much of a stake Universal I mean, I guess they did the Super Mario movie, but like, they don't do anything with Harry Potter except theme parks, because those movies are all Warner Brothers, but Warner Brothers doesn't have the theme park thing in the U.S. anyway. So it just makes me appreciate the relatively utopian vision of Disneyland, as opposed to something that's this crassly commercial.
Yeah.
One thing I thought was interesting was I watched the full YouTube video that was announcing this park, and I went to the comments. I mean, YouTube comments are not the most reliable source of anything, but I expected people to be like, this looks lame, Disney's better, and it was exactly the opposite. I think the worm is kind of turning on, like, Disney esteem right now for various reasons, and people were, like, a lot of the comments were like, this is going to blow, you know, Disney World out of the water. Who knows if that's actually going to be the case, but people love that Harry Potter land that's already at Universal, so they clearly know what they're doing in terms of coming up with these concepts. I think it's partly because they poached a lot of Imagineers from Disney.
We all heard that Richard started that by saying he watched the video of this, right? Like, doing laps around us at every event.
Well, speaking of movies, this is the thing I'm very excited about, even if it's not necessarily going to lead to anything theme park related. But Pedro Almodovar is working with Julianne Moore and Tilda Swinton on his very first English language feature film. It's going to be called The Room Next Door. It's going to start filming in March, and it's already been picked up to be distributed by his longtime studio partners at Sony Pictures Classics. Almodovar has described the film as the story of, quote, a very imperfect mother and her resentful daughter who lives separate lives because of a profound misunderstanding, unquote. Is this important? Do you care?
What's important to me is I feel I can describe 88% of his movies with that tagline. And I'm grateful for it. I do
He's
love
got
this
a vibe.
Right? If I'm gonna watch a Pedro movie in English, a feature, as Alonzo says, because of course he's done short films in English language. Julianne Moore and Tilda Swinton, get in there. I mean, I feel like you could put together a whole dream list of female actors.
Any actress you like.
Right? Like, who would not be like, yes, get me in that. Get me in that room. But those two certainly. Also, I really want to read it as like that Julianne Moore and Tilda Swinton are the mother and daughter. I know that's not it, but it's very funny to me to think that might be it.
Tilda Swinton just made a movie where she played her own mother, so like anything
the
is
eternal,
possible.
Yeah, oh, the Eternal Daughter. I loved it so much. I mean, that's fair. She's played an octogenarian more than once at this point. Don't let me tell Tilda Swinton what she can do in any language.
Yeah. It's I'm ready, and I'm also ready for some folks who might be opened up to Pedro Almodovar through this film. And you know, I feel like there's a lot of like, you
the
know,
non-subtitles folks.
Oh yeah, yes, exactly. I was trying to find the perfect way to shade them, but that's what we'll call,
we call
it this
them
time.
Clerks.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are my people. Yeah.
Yes. All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be orchestrating a conversation about the movie Maestro.
Soundheap with John Luke Roberts is a real podcast made up of fake podcasts. Like, if you had a cupboard in your lower back, what would you keep in it?
So I'm going to say mugs.
A little yogurt and a spoon.
A small handkerchief that was given to me by my grandmother on her deathbed.
Maybe some spare honey?
I'd keep batteries in it. I'd pretend to be a toy.
If I had a cupboard in my lower back, I'd probably fill it with spines.
If you had a cupboard in your lower back, what would you keep in it? Doesn't exist. We made it up for Soundheap with John Luke Roberts, an award-winning comedy podcast from Maximum Fun, made up of hundreds of stupid podcasts. Listen and subscribe to Soundheap with John Luke Roberts now.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm your host, Ify Wadiway, in the studio with me are...
Drea Clark.
Richard Lawson.
Alonso Duraldi.
And today's film was directed by its star, Bradley Cooper. It's Cooper's second film as a director, and it follows the life of notable conductor and composer Leonard Bernstein, and especially of his marriage. Drea, would you mind giving us a brief synopsis of Maestro?
Well, that kind of was it. That's the gist of it. So we're following Leonard Bernstein, revered American composer. And, you know, we start off, we see him as an older gentleman still tinkling away on the ivories. And then we flash back to the early 40s, where we see him sort of rise up, beginning with the New York Philharmonic, making a name for himself, as a conductor. And, you know, he's in a relationship with a young man played by Matt Bomer at the time. But then he quickly meets who becomes the love of his life? Question mark.
question mark.
His long-term spouse. This is me screwing up a name. Felicia Montealegre. Yep, sure.
Montealegre, I think.
Montealegre. Love it. And, and so we follow their lives together as, you know, she moves up as an actress, he moves up in the world of music, and they build a family, and he has assorted affairs, and all sorts of things are happening, and also West Side Story. Maestro!
Ooh. So, I guess we'll kick this off by talking about Bradley Cooper's multi-year mission to get this movie made. Do you think his love for the subject matter came across?
My thing about this movie, and I think there's a lot that I like, and I want to get into that at some point. But off the top, I have to wonder, is this the most interesting version of Leonard Bernstein's life that he could have chosen to tell us? And I don't know if it's the whole living children aspect of it where he had to sort of make this the central thing, but I don't know that his relationship with his wife is the way I would have chosen to go. I don't know. And I kind of feel like because of that, we wind up leaving a lot of what makes Bernstein singular and fascinating on the floor. Discuss.
I agree. And it's a complicated film to discuss because I do think there are set pieces in this that are extraordinary. Yes. There are moments of performance where I'm like, oh, they are in it. Like they're these actors who are eating it up and they're enjoying it so much. And I really love, you know, watching that part of it. So like there's these huge sort of epic shots. Like there's filmmaking in it that I think is noteworthy and commendable and can be drawn in. I agree with Alonzo. The pivoting of it, or what it's decided to pivot its story on, it comes across as almost disappointing because I don't know at the end of this if I feel any more insight to what drove their relationship or why he decided to marry a woman for so long and if this was going to be an exploration of a man who thought of himself as pansexual or bisexual. You know, he alludes several times of, I have so much love to give. And that, like, that's kind of what it is. But that's not really what's being explored here. And because of it, it makes the framework of it kind of difficult to, I'm not sure who you want me to sympathize with. And I don't know if my conflicted feelings are in line with where they should be. But I also understand, as an artist, like Bradley Cooper looking at this and, you know, taking it over, because this was, you know, initially a Martin Scorsese film, and I think Spielberg was going to do it for a minute, and then ended up casting him, you know, saying, like, you should do this and play it yourself. And I kind of like, what if one of them had directed him with it? Like, would it have had a different through line? Because I think his performance is, he was in it, you guys. He was feeling his Leonard.
Yeah, it's so funny, because, you know, I've often said you can always tell when it's a writer director, editor director, or actor director, and I think that this is one of those such cases where it's like, yeah, no, there are great performances, and it feels like this movie is a vehicle for great performances. But I think, you know, when you have a bunch of great performances, and you don't necessarily, you can leave people wanting and leave people trying to figure out what were you trying to have them get from this experience. Because as with my actor cap, I can see why an actor would be like, yeah, I'd love to play this conflicted man who's going to be having all these arguments and all these kind of self introspection. And this is going to look so good on the screen. But it's like, what are you telling us about, you know, this person, when this is the part of their life that you're focusing on?
I think a lot of the press about the movie is kind of telling about the end product, which is that, like, Cooper, you know, did all this extensive training and research, and, you know, he already was a big Bernstein fan from childhood, but he really got even more into it to make this film. And I think that's admirable, and I think it affects the performance in good ways. Like, I think he's really good in the film, but I think that, as can often happen when you're doing something that you're that passionate about, you're too close to it. I think he doesn't step back and get the picture, and kind of like what Iffy was saying, like, consider the audience in this and what they're taking away from it. So you get this kind of weird muddle between, is it a biopic of someone's career? No, not really, even though it sort of starts that way. Is it a love story-ish kind of thing? Sort of, but then it also gets distracted by the music. And I think that I think if he'd had a little more perspective, which is probably pretty hard when you're writing, directing, starring, it's conducting. If he'd had that perspective, I think maybe he would have seen the shape of the movie a bit better.
That's kind of my thought on how I would have almost wanted someone else to direct him in this.
Yes.
Because I do think he really, you know, there's sometimes it can be like, all right, it's a little self-indulgent, easy with the wig and nose. Like, but I felt, like you said, such a genuine affinity towards this man and his place in American culture and, you know, all of the backgrounds. But the forest for the trees is so real, in that we watch a lot of esoteric stuff. Like, I'll watch things with real mangled narratives, with just the slightest sense of a theme. This movie, there were numerous times that I'm like, what in the world are they talking about right now? Like, I feel pretty, I can handle Shakespeare, I can handle Old English, but numerous times in this, I'm like, I don't know what these humans, American, are speaking about.
I think it either needed to be more abstract or impressionistic or whatever, or less. I think it's in this weird middle ground where you're getting some of the straight biopic stuff that the movie kind of claims to be allergic to, and then you're getting stuff that's just more dreamy and sort of, you know, lyrical and not really that narrative. And I would like either movie, probably, but I think kind of melding the two in this exact configuration doesn't work on the whole, even though I love, again, the performances.
Yeah, I think there's a film to be made about somebody who is, you know, enters into a marriage with a woman who he has very strong feelings for, but at the same time is, like, still absolutely, you know, sexually attracted to men and has these long-term relationships with men. I mean, that scene where he and Matt Bomer meet in Central Park and sort of, like, kind of acknowledge that it's over, we're married, we have kids now, but, like, there's still that there, like, that's a movie. or a film about just Leonard Bernstein and the impact he had on the culture. And, you know, there's that interview with Edward R. Murrow or whatever, where it's like, you know, oh, you're conducting the Philharmonic and you were at the score to On the Waterfront and you did, and like all of that is fascinating too. You could do like a whole like 32 short films about Glenn Gould movie about that. But yeah, as it is this sort of, it's a lot of big for your consideration moments, but it doesn't paint a picture of either the person or the artist.
Yeah.
I also couldn't figure out what I was supposed to be. Like I said, like with Felicia of, oh, are you a willing participant? You know, like some people, everyone's relationship is up to however they're going to define it.
Sure.
And so it was this idea of, oh, are we getting an insight to you had what we would consider a modern relationship, a mm-hmm. certain understanding, oh, but, yeah. but then it's still under the sort of trappings of the contemporary mores and expectations, and she's like, you're getting sloppy and you can't let people know. And there's a moment when his daughter has heard rumors about something, and then we see Felicia tell him, like, you better not tell her the truth. And those were things I was like, oh, see, now there's a complexity to this that seems so much more tangled or you know, fraught with narrative possibility than what I've been led to think is just this kind of tacit understanding between two adults who went into this, you know, eyes wide open. And yeah, I wanted more of a lot of that too. And you're right, it is there's two, what is it, in every person there's two wolves. Well, there's two wolves in this film, and it's like, pick a wolf.
I also think, you know, there was a lot of talk before its Venice premiere that, like, Mulligan was really the one to watch, that the movie was just as much her story as it was Leonard's. You know, Bradley Cooper deliberately has Carey Mulligan first billed in the film before him. And I admire that intention, but then the movie weirdly omits a lot about Felicia that kind of made her interesting, her politics in particular. I mean, she had this famous or infamous, depending on who you ask, Black Panther Party fundraiser at her house, which Tom Wolfe called like radical chic in this very sneering piece on the event. And she was really out there politically. And that might have been one way to help us get to know her better, mm-hmm. to kind of match the first billing of Carey Mulligan and all the sort of press surrounding her and the love story angle of the movie. And we kind of just didn't get it for whatever reason.
What did you guys think of Richard sort of alluded to this, but I thought, speaking of the wolves, I was expecting a whole other wolf entirely. There's a sequence early on, it might even be like their first interaction or right around then, when he's talking about Jerome Robbins is making this musical on the town, and they're talking through it. And then all of a sudden we see Leonard in character as a sailor dancer and is on stage, and then they're dancing. And I was like, oh dang, is this movie about to be, I was like, is this turning into All That Jazz? I'm like, what is there going to be are we going to have musical interludes? Like, that was such a thing. And then we never saw anything else like that.
Yeah, no, so I had the same feeling of like, oh, this is okay. So we're not going to just do the, and then yeah, we don't. I think the movie never gets that crazy again in terms of having a flight of fancy, basically. And that would have been a perfect way to bring the two wolves together. You know, it's about their relationship, but it's also about what he does, what he actually does in this world, and why he's famous and what makes him legendary. It's almost like, I almost wish now it wasn't there, just because it sets you up to think you're going to get more of that, or that that's going to be the narrative tack here, and it's not. And so you're right. There are a lot of these discrete moments along the way that's like, that's a great scene, that's a great scene, that's a great scene. You know, the conducting moment is breathtaking. The Thanksgiving parade thing. You know, there's a lot of things along the way, but at the end of it, I'm just kind of like, and I still don't really know who these people were, or if I didn't walk into this theater already knowing about Leonard Bernstein and why he matters culturally, I wouldn't have gotten it from this.
I'm so excited. Well, the other thing too is, like you're saying, the music that he's creating along the way, I was waiting for, what's my arc with the music? Like, is it, I mean, even our sweet buddy Lydia Tarr wanted to do Mahler's 7th or 5th, whatever, like Mahler's number. And so, like, we know, like, this is the white whale, like, this is the thing. And I our introduction of the pieces we're getting, there's this whole section of him doing mass, and then he's like, I've done it, I've unlocked it, and then she runs in the background and jumps in the pool, and I was like, I don't understand why she's in the pool. Were you, how did any of you have either a deeper understanding of what was motivating him as an artist, or like what he was intrigued in by music because of this, or were you filling in blanks because you weren't being given that?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm keeping it buck, I mean, for me, it just felt like a music that just had this overtone of composure that was just like, homage to him, I guess. But like, also sometimes it felt like it didn't fit. It felt like, you know, Looney Tunes at times. It just really was shuffling me from scene to scene. I really did feel like things were kind of just happening, like we were seeing good scenes and then something would, but to answer your question specifically, no, I guess my only thing was that he was just a driven artist, and I just was like generic, like he's a driven artist, that's his thing, but signs for it, I don't think I was getting that.
If it, did you like go to the wiki page afterwards and be like, oh okay, you know, I mean, because the movie's really not giving you a ton here, you know.
I mean, the irony is that one of my kind of go-to lines about like is that I just don't like music biopics for the most part. I think they're very rote and they're sort of formulaic. And you know, what I mean, I'm thinking about the trailer for the Amy Winehouse movie coming out, and it's like there's already a great documentary about this. Why is this happening? I appreciate that Cooper tries to do something different. It's not a biopic. It's a sort of like mood piece about this person or these people, and yet I'm sort of like being a hypocrite because I'm like, I kind of wanted it to be more standard, because like this is, as you've said, you know, it's a fascinating life and a fascinating artistic career, and Felicia Montealegre was fascinating in her own way, and like, I don't know, I just think it's funny that I kind of got what I wanted and I didn't want it.
Yeah, but you know, listening to that, I think you're right, where it's like, I think for the Amy Winehouses and like the Bob Marleys of the biopics, that's where it can be like this mood, you know, kind of vibey action thing. I mean, I just totally made your thing sound worse by calling it vibey, but we get what I mean. But like, yeah, for someone like this who aren't just at the top of people's minds, who we might want to learn more about, who we might have to teach some folks, as I point to myself, about, you do kind of want more of that kind of, you know, in-depth, storytelling.
And to your point, Richard, I think you can want something that isn't a conventional biopic and still find this unconventional tack unsuccessful. You know, it's like the old joke about like, I know what non-dairy creamer isn't, but what is it? You know, so it's like this isn't, you know, this isn't Bohemian Rhapsody, but at the same time, it's also not what it should be, you know.
I also think that maybe some of that inexactness or whatever, kind of to your point, Iffy, is that like the movie became this kind of joke online, like people kind of making fun of, well, it started with the nose and that was sort of more serious than a joke. But like, but when the movie was coming out in December on Netflix, like it was kind of just made fun of a lot. And I think part of that might be is that people who endeavored to watch it, who didn't know much about Bernstein, left being like, what did I just watch? That's just these two actors kind of grandstanding. And maybe that's, that kind of acting is not their cup of tea. It happens to be mine. But like, I don't know. I think that if maybe they had kind of sat the viewer down and been like, here's why all of this theatrical huge stuff is happening, it would not have been sort of, you know, had its eyes rolled at it as just a kind of naked awards play.
I think, too, that the idea of what you're getting out of it in terms of the introduction, like for a biopic, if you're getting this, it's the idea of, oh, deep new insight to this person and or an expectation or understanding of their cultural relevance or whatever. And so I don't think because you got neither of those. Stick with me, people. Words are my tool. But I think that the flattening of this is that idea of, oh, I don't know that I'm taking away either. Because there's other movies that have been much more unconventional than this, and much more conventional, where I still feel I've gotten more of a sense of what drives someone as an artist, of, oh, I have to express this thing, or, oh, if I can't do this, or this is why I've chosen this. Like, conducting is a really fascinating, like, he's also a composer, like, there's all sorts of things, but being a conductor is a really unusual path. It's a different kind of training. It's a different, like, you're, and you see him, he has these enormous orchestras and the choir. Like, there's all the, so why that? Like, what do you need all of these voices for? I feel like there's a lot of threads, even more unconventional, that could have been explored with that. I realize I am saying the same thing over and over each time. It's just, it means so much to me, this one thing I have to say.
Yeah, well, you get to the end of the measure and those dots are there and you have to go back to the beginning.
You. Yes. Well,
why don't we go ahead and vote? Get our vote on. The way we vote for movies on this pod is screen it being the highest, stream it being the next level, and skip it being self-explanatory. So who wants to start?
Despite all of my crabbiness about this movie, I'm going to say screen it. And I think that even though it is a Netflix movie, if you are in, you know, in an area with a lot of Oscar voters and you can see it on a screen, do. It was shot by the great Matthew Libatique. And I think there are a lot of, as we said, moments in this movie where Bradley Cooper, the director, is giving us a flex that really is effective and is powerful and sweeping. I got to see it at the Venice Film Festival in one of those great theaters. And so, you know, I think that sells it better than just watching it on Netflix does. The flaws are still there too, but it's worth experiencing those moments that are so magical here.
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Alonzo and say screen it. I mean, I think that there is really interesting work in there. And the 6-minute conducting scene alone is, I think worth it.
No, I agree. I'm also a screen it. I've been really back and forth, but hopefully at the beginning I conveyed, I think there's a lot to be impressed with in this. I do think it's disjointed and I wanted more, or I wanted different things, but is that always fair? Who knows? But those set pieces that stand out are going to stay with me. And there are some really just like, they may be just acting pieces. Like, all right, let's do this scene. We have this pas de deux, basically. But sometimes it's just really wonderful to watch people in a deep performance with ridiculous accents, just in it. And don't you want to hear Carey Mulligan tell him he's going to be a sad old queen? Isn't that what we all want?
Yeah, I was like, damn, that's a burn. Right,
she calls me once a week and tells me that too. So.
Iffy.
Ooh, okay. Yeah, and in spite of you know, all that, I'm that midpoint, but I'm going to lean towards screen it because there are just some beautiful shots. You ain't seen a couple's argument until you've seen a parade float going in the background while they're just tearing each other apart. So on that case, I'm going to go ahead and say that so that, you know, we have a nice balance all across the board, full screen it. That's a projector. That's a projector when everyone votes a screen it. I just made that up, but I'm going to stick with it.
I like that.
So we'll be right back after we hear from another show from Maximum Fun.
Oh, darling, why won't you accept my love?
My dear, even though you are a duke, I could never love you. You borrowed a book from me and never returned it.
Save yourself from this terrible fate by listening to Reading Glasses.
We'll help you get those borrowed books back and solve all your other reader problems.
Reading Glasses, every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
Welcome back to Maximum Film. I'm Yosef Uwadiway. In the studio with me are
Alonzo Duralde,
Richard Lawson,
Drea Clark,
and me, Marissa Flaxbart, producer Marissa, I'm sometimes known around these parts.
Yay!
Well, so I'm here because I am very excited to announce the newest member, the newest inductee to the Hall of Excellence, a very serious hall that exists in our hearts and minds here at Maximum Film. The category was Best Fictional Book from a Movie. And This is a really special one because for the first time, maybe ever, someone's choice of a black and white movie, an older film that happens to have a classic element paid off with 71% of the vote.
Nice!
Wow.
How I Did It by Victor von Frankenstein, Alonzo's pick, is the best fictional book, according to our listeners.
Thank you, listeners. For once, you got it right.
And yes. You guys will be happy to know that you came in second and third, Drea and Iffy.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Don't
get beat out by the guest. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sticking around because, as Iffy teased at the beginning of the episode, we have for you a movie quiz about movie composers. But rather than, you know, the composers of movie soundtracks, these are all movies that are about famous composers.
Oh, no.
As a student of Lydia Tarr might observe, a lot of white men are going to be the answers to this quiz. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read the name of a film, and what you need to do is tell me what composer that movie is about. Yeah. And some of these are going to get hard, but some of these are composers about whom there were multiple movies. So if the first one doesn't tip you off, I can try to step in with another one, okay?
All right. Okay.
All right, Iffy, you know what? I feel there's no way you and I are not going to wipe the floor with Trevor and Alonzo.
Yeah,
I'm going to
get it.
Yeah.
No
way.
We
might have some stumpers all around, actually, for this. I found out about a lot of new movies that I didn't know ever existed today. So, and I am a big classical music fan. So I'm ready to watch them.
I know a single movie, and I'm probably going to miss it.
I think you might be surprised, Drea. Okay. You'll know a few more of these. So just call out when you know the title.
Okay.
Okay, we're going to start with a nice, easy one for you. Maybe this is the one, Drea. The movie is called Amadeus.
Mozart. And Salieri.
Ooh, nice. Okay. There is a movie called De Lovely. Who is it about?
Cole Porter. Ooh. Oh, yeah.
That's right. Anybody know another Cole Porter movie that's
Night
out there?
Night and Day.
Is that right. The Kevin Spacey one and the other one's Kevin Kline?
No, Cary Grant.
Bobby Darin is the...
Oh, that's what I'm thinking of. Thank you. Yeah. Oh, Cary Grant. Right.
Okay, how about Words and Music?
I knew we were going to get into these MGM ones.
Okay, I'll give you a hint, which is that it is about a composing duo, a songwriting duo.
Is it Rodgers and Hart?
I'm so glad. I want you to know I'm thinking of the Hugh Grant and Drew Barrymore movie, and I was like, we have to know that guy's name? He was in a fake Wham? Yeah, okay, go back. My bad, that's lyrics and music.
Music and lyrics,
music
yeah.
Music and lyrics.
And yes, Alonzo, it is Rodgers and Hart. Wow.
Well done. I wasn't even in the right decade.
All right. Have you guys ever heard of a movie called Stars and Stripes Forever?
Ooh, John Philip Sousa. Played by Clifton Webb, of all people, which if you know who Clifton Webb is, that's kind of hilarious.
Yes.
He was Waldo Leidecker in Laura.
One would hope that we would have gotten to Sousa from Stars and Stripes Forever.
Yeah, some of these are like that. Some of them aren't, but I thought that some of them might be a little bit of a nice softball, even if you hadn't heard of the movie, through context clues.
Yeah.
Here's one of those again. Rhapsody in Blue.
Gershwin.
That's right. Bonus points if you can tell me which Gershwin.
George.
That's right.
Played by Robert Alda.
Ooh. How about a film called Death in Venice?
Wait, Death in Venice?
Yeah.
It sounds like Agatha Christie.
It's apparently about a composer.
I mean, it's based on a Thomas Mann novel. I don't think it's a biopic.
Well, maybe there's more than one.
Maybe there's more than one Death in Venice. I don't know.
Yeah.
Richard, I'm very disappointed right now, young man.
I have literally no idea. Stravinsky. I don't know. Do you ever go to Venice?
I love the guess. I love the spirit of the guess.
Tchaikovsky.
It's
Wagner, what I have written down here is Mahler, Gustav Mahler.
Oh, yeah.
But it's possible that I'm wrong, and maybe I'll cut this whole part out of the quiz.
No, you have to own it.
Hastily researched, trademark. Okay, here are a few movies about the same composer. One of the most famous is called Immortal Beloved.
Beethoven. That's the one I knew.
All right.
So he's a dog and Charles Grodin is...
They made so many of these Beethoven movies.
Gary Oldman plays the King Charles Bernard. Spaniel or whatever.
Can anybody think of any other Beethoven movies?
There's one called The Loves of Beethoven, I think.
There is one called Copying Beethoven. Ooh. And a movie that I watched in elementary school, I don't know if you caught this in elementary school, it was called Beethoven Lives Upstairs.
No, they didn't do that at Our Lady of Victory.
In that one, there's a little boy, and guess what, you guys? Beethoven lives upstairs.
What? Ooh. Shocked. Wow. Twist.
Nah. All right. Impossible.
You know who's seen it? Richard Lawson.
I was that boy.
I see. An autobiography of Richard Lawson. Beethoven lives upstairs. All right. I'm going to put you guys out of your misery. I have a lot of deep cuts, but we're going to do a nice fun one that you all may have seen, or some of you may have seen. Some of you have certainly seen Topsy Turvy.
Oh.
Gilbert and Sullivan.
Oh. Yeah.
All right.
Nice.
Okay, thank you all for indulging me in that.
Thank you, Marissa.
Solid research, Marissa.
Yeah,
well done.
Thank you, and thank you to the list makers of Letterboxd. Your help to me is invaluable. And I'll turn it back over to you, Iffy.
All right. Well, yeah, that was a quiz I knew. I wasn't going to, after I missed Amadeus, it was a wrap. So... I'm going to just keep it going. It's time for our staff picks. It could be any movie at all. Who wants to start?
I'll go. Oh, I love that Alonzo and I always stare at each other. Who's going to... We double dutch.
Up to you.
Thank you, sir. Mine, I'm very excited. One of my all-time favorite movies, like top three movies all time. I rewatch it at least once a year. Amelie is being re-released on Valentine's Day. Ooh. To like over 250 theaters across the country. If you have not seen it, go. It's charming as hell. It is an absolute delight. If you don't like it, we can't be friends. I don't know what more I have to say. Please go see Amelie. It has subtitles. It's good for you. But it's so great. It's wonderful.
Yes.
I'm going to recommend a movie I mentioned in passing in our Meister discussion, which is Francois Girard's 32 short films about Glenn Gould. It's about the legendary Canadian classical pianist. And I think it's one of the best film biopics about a musician I've ever seen, because it really takes an unconventional tack. It is sort of the things that we wanted out of Maestro in terms of putting us into this performer's head and this artist and how he hears the world and how he portrays, you know, how the music comes out of him, basically. And you know, it's told in a very sort of impressionistic way, and it doesn't follow the beats that you're expecting, but by the end of it you really get it, and you, even if you are as you know, tin-eared as I am, you come away with this appreciation of how he loved music and how, you know, what it meant to him and how he was able to convey that through his work. So it is currently available for rental on iTunes, and if you've never seen it, I highly recommend it. And there's also a Simpsons episode called 32 Short Films About Springfield, which will make more sense to you after you see 32 Short Films About Glenn Gould.
Nice.
One of the great Simpsons episodes, for sure.
Yes.
Yes. My recommendation is something that I had never seen before, which was surprising to me because it was up my alley when I was a kid. It's Death Trap, the movie adaptation of the play. It's Ira Levin wrote it, Sidney Lumet directed the movie, Michael Caine. And I was inspired to watch it partly because there was a Christopher Reeve documentary at Sundance this year that sold for $15 million, which is crazy for a documentary. So I think there's going to be a lot of Christopher Reeve, you know, retrospective coming our way. And so I wanted to get a jump on that. And he is hunky as hell in that movie and really funny.
So
and
beautiful.
What a talented actor he was. I mean, because he was a theater guy. And so he gets to show more of that in this very funny arch movie about theater and murder, and Diane Cannon's great in it. I really had a great time with it.
Ooh, yeah. Good one. Time to bring back Merchant Ivory's The Bostonians, too.
I was literally, that's what I was just going to say. I watched that last year because I did a Merchant Ivory draft with Guy Branum.
Yeah, you did. Ooh. I listened to that one.
The Bostonians. Solid.
Well, you know, we were talking about Bradley Cooper's great performance today, so obviously I had to pick another film in which he had a phenomenal performance, life-changing for some. Peak cinema, some would call it. Of course, it's director Todd Phillips' The Hangover, you know, which, you know, some say was his first maestro. Some would say, you know, that is the, so, you know, that's what the streets are saying. Definitely check that one out if you haven't.
Some might say that, you know, he started with paging Dr. Faggot in The Hangover and then played Dr. Faggot in Maestro.
I wouldn't.
Yeah.
I think we'd all say
Alonzo would say it, but I'm not going to be mad at him for saying
it. This was my confusion. Bradley Cooper plays Stravinsky in The Hangover. That's what I was thinking of.
Oh, well, thank you so much to Richard Lawson. Where can folks find your work?
They can go to vanityfair.com or just type vf.com. It's very easy. Where I have a few reviews every week, maybe some other stuff too. Coming up, I'll have every year I do a 20-year recap of 20 years ago Oscars. So like this year it'll be the 2004 ceremony. Lots of gifts. It takes me a long time to make it, so please read it. It'll be up the week of the Oscars.
Nice.
Oh, I always love Richard's writings.
And just for inquiring minds, where would people who want to get into all the Vanity Fair parties email you at? What is the email? You can say that.
You can email me, but just make one typo in the name.
All right. Dre and Alonzo, thank you for another wonderful show as well. You are amazing. And you, listener, thank you for listening to us. It's always great to hear your thoughts and know that you're loving what we're saying, or maybe you have thoughts about what we're saying. And if you have a comment or suggestion about this week's show, send us an email at MaximumFilm@MaximumFun.org or find us on any of our social media channels, which are all linked in the show notes. Next week, we're going to be talking about Lisa Frankenstein, and our producer is the wonderful Marissa Flaxbart. Our senior producer is the also wonderful Laura Swisher. And this is a production of Maximum Fun. Bye-bye.
Maximum Fun,
a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows,
supported
directly
by you.